really like a mm-hmm. you know assembly line of
Sight testing can be very useful. Some tests are more useful than others. The time, you know, when sight testing is most useful, makes most sense, is either when I need to get to know somebody quickly so I can render opinions, or when I need data to back up my opinions. So our partner, Warren Salkin, does a bunch of pre-employment screening for police forces and fire departments and so on. And so his task is, meet with this person once or twice, figure out if they're going to be a good police officer. Mm. Well, in an hour or two with a person, I'm not going to get to know them well enough. Mm-hmm. You know, but the sight test can get that data in that amount of time. And also, if I'm just relying on my subjective impressions in rendering opinions, this is not terribly reliable. You know, if I've got some empirical, you know, evidence that, yes, people who score high on these things are good prospects and people who score high on those things are bad prospects, then I'm going to end up making much better recommendations than if I'm just going on my subjective impression. And there have been times in my career when I've done lots of sight testing and damn good at it. But if what I'm doing is doing therapy, I'm going to be meeting with the person more than once or twice. I'm going to end up getting to know them real well. You know, most of the time, the sight testing doesn't add anything value. You know, so I'm very selective about using sight testing rather than routinely doing sight testing with everybody, which is a way to generate revenue without adding value, which is not the way I want to do business. Meanwhile, back at personality disorders. Let's take a look at paranoid personality disorder, not because it's the most important personality disorder or the most common personality disorder. It happens to be the one where applying this model is most straightforward and easiest to explain. We'll start with the easy stuff and work our way up to the more complicated stuff. What are we talking about? Well, on page 6, we've got the DSM-5 criteria for paranoid personality disorder. You know, this is somebody who's characterized by pervasive distrust and suspiciousness, and we've got a whole list of different ways it can manifest itself. And so basically, this is somebody who doesn't trust people, thinks people can't be trusted, and this causes an assortment of problems in their lives. They're not psychotic. You know, and so we're talking about a purely cognitive problem. You know, my perception of other people screws things up. And you know, that makes it sound like, gee, if I could just convince this person that people aren't malicious and deceptive, then poof, their problems would go away and they'd be a lot better. That sounds good. Have you ever tried to convince a paranoid person that people aren't deceptive and malicious? If you've tried that, you've discovered how well it works. You know, at best it's ineffective. You know, at worst it gets you added to the bad list. It don't work. And so we're actually going to need to understand what's going on and figure out how to deal with it. But the first challenge is spotting it. Because how often does a paranoid individual come into your office saying, Doc, my problem is I don't trust people. Help me trust people. I don't think I've ever had anybody present that way. You know, traditionally, paranoid personality disorder was reputed to be rarely encountered in practice. The idea was these people aren't so screwed up that they need involuntary treatment. They don't see their suspiciousness and distrust as a problem. They think they're being wise to be skeptical in dealing with others. They don't like the idea of opening up and being vulnerable, so they're not going to come in under their own power to seek treatment. So they're out there in the world being paranoid and having issues, but not coming in for help with it. That sounds reasonable. It makes sense to me. However, you know, one day, I noticed, gee, wait a minute. I've got a lot of people with paranoid personality disorder in my caseload at the moment. You know, one possibility is I've got really bizarre referral sources and all the paranoids are being shipped to me. Another possibility is people with paranoid personality disorder are in treatment more commonly than we've realized, but it's not being noticed. And if you stop and think about it, this person doesn't come in saying, "Doc, I'm paranoid, help me trust people." Their tendency is to come in and say, "This person's mistreating me in this way, and that person's mistreating me in that way, and these people are terrible to me." And if you don't stop and think, it sounds like we've got an innocent victim of malicious treatment by their boss and their spouse and their parents and their neighbors, etc.
You mean therapists aren't recognizing that they have this individual in front of them?
Right. Good example. Let's go to the videotape.
It's controlling is another issue with the people, the paranoid person, trying to control others.
Well, that's one interpersonal strategy they may well use. You know, if I don't want to be vulnerable to others, trying to control them is one of the options. We'll get into that a little more. But the video I've got here is produced and sold as a part of a series of demos, teaching examples about anxiety disorders. Why am I playing this now? So it's a married housewife
telling me how it was that you did seek help at the clinic.
Well, in 1986, I had a situation where police officers came to my door. Earlier in the day, I had yelled at my son outside, and they said that I abused a child. They came to the door and said, "I abused a child." And I said, "My son went for a ride with my mom." And they said, "Well, you know, where is the child? Is he dead? What did you do with him?" And I said, "Look, why don't we go upstairs and talk about this?" They were really nasty, and the landlady was in the hall at the time. They came to the door with guns drawn, and they were really, really nasty. And they handcuffed me, like they were like taunting and everything else. They were saying, "You killed your son, you did." I said, "Hold it, my son will be back in about 10 minutes, and you can talk to him, and you'll see he's all right." In the interim, while I was being pulled down the steps by two police officers with handcuffs, you know, behind my back, my son came with my mom, and there were people outside, which was the most embarrassing thing, because, you know, all these people, half of them I don't even know. They all come out like they're giving away free turkeys at welfare, you know, and they...
So why am I playing this video when I'm talking about, you know, paranoid personality disorder? This is being presented to us as a case example of PTSD. Isn't this lady just an innocent victim of police brutality? Well, that's certainly the way she presents it. And if you just listen to the story, it's a, "Gee, well, those were terrible police, you know, and she's not even black and they're being terrible to her, you know, etc." But if you stop and think about it, wait, the story she's saying is she yelled at her son, and therefore, the police showed up at her door the next day, later that day. Wait a minute. Suppose somebody was, you know, the neighbor thinks I'm abusing my kid. What are the odds of the police showing up later that day? I'd have to do something pretty damn extreme to have the police showing up. You know, the wheels do not turn that fast unless the players involved think this is an emergency situation. You know, if I do manage to conduct myself in such a way that the police get called and show up at my door later that day, you know, am I going to be dragged down the stairs in handcuffs? Well, it depends on how I interact with the police. You know, I certainly could interact with the police in such a way that I end up getting dragged down the stairs in handcuffs, but... You know, and it depends some on which policeman you cross paths with, but there's a whole element of her role in these interactions that she's not presenting, she's not recognizing. And I don't know any more about the details of the case than you guys do, But I'm willing to bet that it wasn't garden variety yelling at your kid. That she didn't interact with the police calmly and reasonably when they showed up. Now, her comment about the worst thing was people were gathering around while like they were passing away free turkeys at welfare. A, if I'm dragged down the stairs by police in handcuffs, a crowd gathering is not going to be the worst part of this situation. You know, since she sounds like she's real sensitive to being exposed to the scrutiny of others, and is expressing a very disparaging view of others. And if we took the time to listen to the rest of this, she ends up getting taken to Bellevue and ends up in restraints at Bellevue and ends up doing a tour of duty in the state hospital. You know, they take her to, why do they take her to Bellevue, not the police station? Yeah. And she's taken to Bellevue and put in a room, so of course she starts banging on the door. That's her words. You know, and so it turns out, yes, she probably does have PTSD. It happened to be raining while all this happened, and now each time it rains she has flashbacks. So yes, she has PTSD. However, that sounds like the least of her problems as far as I can tell. Yeah, one thing that's real handy to notice is that if we just listen to the person's story without thinking about it, it's easy to overlook important cues. And one thing that's useful with all of the personality disorders is to have in mind a great diagnostic criteria are handy, but they only apply if we realize, oh, could this be person have paranoid personality disorder? Let me look at the criteria. It's handy to have some red flags, some early warning signs to alert me, oh, I might want to consider. And so at the bottom of page 6, we have an assortment of possible indications to watch out for. These are not intended as alternate diagnostic criteria. A bunch of them could apply to a variety of people, not just people with paranoid personality disorder. But if I spot a number of these, it's real handy to register, could this person be more paranoid than they're letting on? What do I already know that fits with that? What do I need to find out? And then we're less likely to overlook the Axis II disorder when it's there. And since this is something that we need to take into account and make adjustments for, the sooner we spot it, the better our odds are of being helpful to the person. So, you know, one case example I've got is, we'll refer to this guy as J.E. Successful executive at a major corporation in town, 55 years old, divorced twice. He was referred to me by a psychiatrist because he has chronic pain secondary to some dental surgery, and chronic pain in medical applications is one area I do some work in. Due to his chronic pain, he's depressed and has suicidal ideation. The scenario is, a few years ago, he had some minor dental pain, just a dull ache, but he couldn't tolerate it. And so he consulted his dentist, consulted a dental surgeon, da-da-da-da. And the dental surgeon said, well, there is some surgery we could try, but I really recommend against it. It's more likely to make the problem worse than to make it better. The guy insisted on having the surgery anyway. It did indeed make it worse, not better. And from his description, the pain is now, it's gone from a dull ache to moderate intensity. He described it as being about the same intensity as a standard garden variety headache. But he could not tolerate it. And what was hard to tolerate about it is not having control over it. He said, quote, things you can't control, you have to push aside. He couldn't control the pain, and he couldn't push it aside. So he became more and more preoccupied with it. He dropped his usual activities. It seemed to him that this was something he had to keep secret from everybody around him, because if they knew, they would think less of them. They would think he was inadequate. They would think he was incompetent. His standing at work would go down, etc. And so at this point, he's preoccupied with this chronic pain. He's discontinued all of his activities other than work. He's preoccupied by his inability to control the pain. He denies any anger about this. And when I inquired about that, he said, quote, what good will it do? which is an interesting response when you ask somebody if they're ever angry. He had insisted on divorcing his wife, even though she didn't want a divorce, because he was convinced that eventually she would hold his pain against him, see him as inadequate because he has chronic pain, and she would divorce him. So he insisted on beating her to the punch by divorcing her, even though she didn't want a divorce and there weren't any major problems in their relationship. In his first marriage, the woman he married happened to be from New Jersey. They came to Cleveland because of his job. She's here with him in Cleveland. She missed her mother, and she asked him if she could go back during the summer to visit her mom. He really did not want her to go visit her mom, so he said, "Sure, dear." And so she went and visited her mom, and he was really upset about it, even though he hadn't given her any indication he didn't want her to go. And so he made a point of having an affair that summer to get even with her. The surface presentation, there was nothing evident about paranoid personality disorder, but when you start thinking about the details, a lot of these different possible indications, start standing out. How are we going to make sense of paranoid personality disorder and figure out how to be helpful with it? Well, we're going to turn to the top of page 7, where we've got our handy-dandy cognitive model of paranoid personality disorder, and I'm going to introduce it in a series of steps so as to make it easier to get one's head around. First of all, on the left-hand side, we have some underlying assumptions which end up playing an important role in this. One is your standard, not terribly surprising, view that people are malicious and deceptive. And it seems to me that people in general are malicious and deceptive, this does have some effects. When I go out in day-to-day life and interact with people in different situations, I'm going to expect them to be malicious, deceptive, hostile, try to take advantage of me, so on. And, along with this is a belief that they'll attack me if they get a chance, which is also going to encourage me to be alert for signs of maliciousness and deceptiveness and so on. And suppose I go through day-to-day life on the lookout for people being malicious and deceptive and hostile, trying to take advantage of me and so on. A, I'll spot it when it happens. And if you go through life, you will spot times when people are being malicious and deceptive and so on. I mean, just this week, I've gotten more than a half dozen robocalls from various companies misrepresenting themselves and trying to take advantage of me in various ways. We're calling in response to your request for information. No, you aren't, dude. I haven't requested information from anybody. We represent Dominion Gas, it turns out. No, they don't represent Dominion Gas. And so if I go through life being vigilant for signs of maliciousness and deception and so on, first of all, I'll spot it when it's happening. And then all those observations reinforce my belief that people are malicious and deceptive, etc. But also, a lot of interactions are ambiguous enough that they're open to interpretation. If I'm supposed to meet somebody for dinner and they show up half an hour late and they claim they were stuck in traffic, if I go into it unbiased, that's quite believable. I've been stuck in traffic before. But if I have this preconception that people are malicious and deceptive and they'll take advantage of me if they get a chance, then it makes it a lot easier to feel like this person is jerking me around and then coming up with an excuse to get themselves off the hook. And a lot of interactions are ambiguous enough that they're open to interpretation. So in addition to all the times when I spot maliciousness and deception and so on when it's really happening, there also are going to be a lot of times when I misconstrue ambiguous situations, and this also produces experiences which reinforce my view that people are malicious and deceptive and so on. And so we get a constant flow of confirmatory evidence. We've got the third assumption, you can be okay only if you don't let your guard down, which also reinforces the vigilance. and contributes to more confirmatory evidence. And each time I'm vigilant and on guard and it turns out okay, it seems like it's working and I'd better keep it up. The times when I'm vigilant and on guard and I get shafted anyway, seems like I didn't do a good enough job, I'd better try harder. So this becomes strongly self-perpetuating pretty easily. And notice, so far we're just talking about what goes on inside the person's head. But also, if I believe that people are malicious and deceptive and will attack me if they get a chance, and the only way to be safe is to constantly be on guard, you know, on the top of page 8, this is also going to impact my interpersonal behavior. You know, if I see people as malicious and deceptive and trying to take advantage of me, am I going to be nice and kind and benevolent in my interactions with others? Am I going to be warm and cuddly? No, the odds are I'm going to be cool and distant because I don't want to give people a chance to take advantage of me. The odds are I'm going to be on guard and ready to react strongly if I spot anything fishy. And if you're interacting with somebody who treats you as though you're malicious and deceptive and, you know, being mean to them when you haven't done anything yet, how do you find yourself reacting to that? Does that bring out the best in you? You're then all nice, warm, and cuddly. Most people find that this pisses them off. Years ago, there was a battery commercial where Robert Conrad, the actor who played Pappy Boynton in a show that nobody remembers anymore, etc., you know, had a battery sitting on his shoulder and his saying, "Knock this battery off my shoulder, I dare you." Well, there are lots of bars in town where if you approach people with that stance, they'll be more than happy to knock the battery off his shoulder and then knock your head off your shoulders too. That if you approach people in a hostile, confrontational stance, if you react to people, if you're cold and distant and don't let people get to know you, this does not bring out the warm and cuddly in others. In fact, it's likely to get you treated worse than the average person gets treated, which produces more confirmatory evidence, which tends to prove that people are malicious and deceptive. And, you know, why is it hard to intervene with Axis II disorders? Well, if we can only convince a person that people aren't malicious and deceptive, then they wouldn't be so vigilant, they wouldn't be so guarded, and things would go better. But how are we going to convince them that people aren't malicious and deceptive when they're constantly spotting times when people are malicious and deceptive and they're misinterpreting, you know, times that are ambiguous? Well, if we could get them to be less vigilant, they wouldn't be spotting so many things that seem to confirm their beliefs. But how are we going to get them to be less vigilant when it seems like people are malicious and deceptive and are going to try to do them in? You know, if we could get them to be less guarded and defensive and nicer to people, they'd get treated better. But how are we going to get them to be nice to other people if they believe that everybody's trying to do them in? This sounds pretty challenging to intervene with. Now, those of you who are being vigilant and on guard, probably is not necessarily a bad strategy. Probably have noticed, wait a minute, there's something on this last diagram he hasn't mentioned yet. You know, we got self-efficacy in there. And in terms of thinking about options for intervening effectively, if you think about it, you know, if it seems to me people are going to be malicious, deceptive, hostile, try to take advantage of me, and this is a big threat to me, then I'm going to be really vigilant and on guard and really prone to react quickly. If it seems to me people are malicious and deceptive, but I can handle it, then I don't need to be so vigilant and on guard and defensive and so on. You know, do I need to be vigilant and on guard when the phone rings? No, I'm confident that if somebody's trying to, you know, mislead me over the phone, that I can spot that and hang up on them just fine. I don't need to be vigilant. You know, I pick up the phone, I listen to what person says, I hang up on them, and life goes on. And so, suppose, you know, I'm working with somebody who's vigilant and on guard and defensive and all this cycle is going on, and I can increase their sense of self-efficacy, their sense that they can handle the threats in these situations, that they can deal with people if people try to take advantage of them. They can spot risk without having to be so damn vigilant. Then I've got a shot at toning down the vigilance a little bit. If the vigilance goes down a bit, then they're not spotting as many incidences that reinforce their beliefs and assumptions. And that would tone down the intensity of the cycle a little bit, which might make it easier to tone down their vigilance a little more. You know, if I can increase their self-efficacy, then maybe I can get them to be a little less guarded and defensive, cut people a little slack, be a little more reasonable in dealing with others, and this might get somewhat better responses from others, which again would reduce the flow of confirmatory evidence and make it easier to decelerate things. And if I can get to the point where the person's vigilance is down a couple notches and their guardedness and defensiveness is down a couple notches, then we're starting to get some experiences don't fit with the idea that people are always malicious and deceptive. And now maybe I've got a shot at chipping away at their dysfunctional thoughts in specific situations, eventually chipping away at the beliefs and assumptions, and helping them shift to a more adaptive behavior that works out better for them. And, seems to me that if I just jump in without thinking strategically, it's going to be really tough to intervene effectively here. If I can think strategically and figure out what the best odds of success are, then I've got a much better chance of intervening effectively. How's this sound so far? Any questions at this point? Now, so how do we put this into practice in real life? Well, the first thing is,
Sorry, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So a client such as the example we saw,
mm-hmm.
came for a PTSD, would you, would the paranoid personality would be secondary? Is that how you would diagnose them?
I'd need more information to figure out if it's secondary or primary.
Mm-hmm.
In the case on the videotape, it sounds to me like she's had paranoid personality disorder way before she developed the PTSD. I don't know that. I'd need a lot more information, but that's the way it sounds to me. So it sounds to me like in this case she had paranoid personality disorder in the first place, and the paranoid personality disorder actually played a role in the PTSD. I think she's got two freestanding problems, both of which she's going to need help with. But it sounds to me like the paranoid personality disorder is the bigger problem. Now, in real life, first of all, I need to sit down and do a good evaluation, and I need to know a lot more than we know at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to talk over goals and priorities for therapy. And one issue that comes up with most of the Axis II disorders is the client isn't coming in saying, cure me of, the person with dependent personality disorder doesn't come in saying, help me be assertive and independent. That idea freaks them out. The compulsive doesn't come in saying, help me mellow out and be less perfectionistic. That idea freaks them out. The paranoid individual's not going to come in and say, doc, help me trust people. And so if I launch into trying to get the compulsive to mellow out and the dependent to be more assertive and independent and the paranoid to trust people, this is non-collaborative. The person's going to fight me on it. I'm not likely to win that one. So that's not the way I want to approach this. I'm going to negotiate goals for therapy, starting off with finding out what brings them in here. What do they want to get out of therapy? Good example in the textbook, Gary, a young early 30s single guy in a medically related field, came in asking for help with stress management. He had a pretty stressful lifestyle. He was working full time in a health related field. I don't remember which one I chose, in the text, so I'll leave it vague so I don't accidentally get the wrong one. And he was also in grad school, and he was also in a somewhat complex relationship. So he had plenty of stress going on in his life. He also had irritable bowel syndrome, which tended to act up when his stress got worse. and that was a major concern for him. And in his initial presentation, he didn't give any particular signs of paranoid personality disorder. Sounds like seeking help with stress management. We work on stress management, and it wasn't hard to negotiate goals, there. And we started doing the ordinary stress management stuff, which worked fine for six sessions. And we were doing progressive relaxation training. We were looking at dysfunctional thoughts, etc. And in his sixth session, he came in and reported that he was starting to have times when the relaxation exercises didn't work, in quotes. And this caught my attention because I've had plenty of people for whom relaxation exercises were quite helpful. I've had plenty of people for whom relaxation exercises didn't work at all. I haven't had anybody where the relaxation exercises worked just fine and then stopped working. So what do I do? Wait a minute, I'm doing CBT here. I take a specific situation. Can you give me a good example of a time when the relaxation exercises didn't work? Oh, he was at work, walking down the hallway. He got really anxious, and he couldn't relax. Okay, well, tell me a little more about the situation. Well, he's walking down the hallway. A co-worker's approaching from the other direction. What does he remember feeling? He remembers feeling really anxious. Does he remember what thoughts were running through his head? I don't want him stealing my ideas. Every little thing you say is used against you. People are out to take you for what they can get. Those are all quotes. Aha! This dude is more paranoid than I realized. Because we talked it over. He had some reasons to be skeptical about this coworker, but not any major betrayal or anything dramatic. And it also turned out it was not just with this specific guy, but this was his approach to people in general, had been for years, and played a major role in his stress. And what happened in this situation, it wasn't that he tried relaxing and it didn't work. It was that he was not willing to relax because it seemed like if he let his guard down, this guy would take advantage of it. And actually, the guy was just walking past him in the hallway. It was hard to see how the guy could have taken advantage of him if he wanted to. In a lot of cases, the paranoid personality is not apparent at first. We've developed goals for therapy. A lot of my paranoid individuals want help with stress management because it is a pretty stressful lifestyle. Often people want help with relationship problems. J.E. wanted help with pain management and depression. And obviously, if I haven't even noticed the paranoid personality yet, I'm going to start working on the goals we agree on. And then it becomes apparent later on, and wait a minute, we got other issues here too. How do I approach this? If I just say, dude, you're too suspicious, let me help you trust people, this is not going to be a big seller. What I need to do is frame it in terms of the goals we're working for. Okay, well, our top priority is stress management here. Sounds like your suspicions about this guy's intentions got in the way of using the stress management techniques, so they didn't work very well for you. Sounds like what we need to do is take a look at your suspicions of this guy and figure out how to handle that so it doesn't muck up dealing with stress. How does that sound to you? And if I frame the work on their suspicions as a way of overcoming an impediment to their goals, then it's collaborative. They're motivated to work on this with me. I'm not trying to force them to do something they don't want to do. That works great. Likewise, if the paranoia is obvious at first, with J.E., I spotted that in the initial evaluation. And so there, too, I want to frame it in terms of goals he wants to accomplish. Gee, from what you're saying, politics at work really get to you. It's hard to, one of the things that complicates dealing with your pain is it seems like you got to keep it secret from everybody. Seems I understand you. You want help with pain management? Great, we'll do that. You want help with your depression? Great, you'll do that. It seems like figuring out how to deal with office politics, the way people would react if they knew about your pain, etc., also plays a role in this. What would you think of also you know, sorting out how, you know, people's likely reactions impact dealing with pain and figure out how to handle things so that that's not a problem. That makes sense to him. He's willing to sign on to that. And it puts us in a position where we can work collaboratively on his view of others, his expectations, his current way of dealing with his concerns, and looking at more promising alternatives. So with a lot of access to disorders, we're going to be addressing this stuff because it's an impediment to achieving what they want to achieve on more access one issues. Now, and I'll get the client's vote on what to start with. Yeah?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So what is the thin line between PTSD and paranoia?
Well, it's not that there's a thin line.
Because, it's, you know, how, especially if it's coming from, like, PTSD out of criminals or something that, you know, like, people are dangerous. So, like, how would you know, you know, is it... It is PTSD because all the symptoms are there, but maybe the paranoia is behind all of that.
Right. Well, so part of that is doing a good evaluation. And if the person sees people as dangerous and they have, you know, and they have good reason to believe these particular individuals have been, you know, are dangerous because they've been, you know, if this person has stabbed me in the past, then perceiving them as dangerous is not paranoid, it's reality-based. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's going to be specific, you know, that's going to be specific individuals have given me reason to distrust them. If this person has robbed me in the past, you know, that's different from seeing people in general this way. Now, if the person grew up in a part of town with a big criminal subculture and everybody is malicious and deceptive and beating them up and robbing them and so on, you know, you could have broad general suspiciousness that's reality-based. That's not paranoia. That's growing up in a really tough neighborhood. And so one of the things that I need to sort out is, are this person's suspicions realistic or not? You know, if somebody thinks their spouse is cheating on them, you know, this could be some degree of paranoia. It could be they've picked up that their spouse is cheating on them. How do I know? I don't know their spouse. Now, one of the things we do a lot in cognitive therapy is identify specific thoughts and then examine the evidence. So, you know, Gary's walking down the hallway thinking, I don't want him stealing my idea. Every little thing you say is used against you, etc. I can take those one at a time. I don't want him stealing my idea. That was, and what do you think of that thought now? You know, do you see good reasons to believe there's a risk of him stealing your ideas? And I'll find out about their history, and maybe this guy has stolen his ideas in the past. Maybe he hasn't. You know, I'll find out. And as I find out the specifics, then I'm in a better position to judge whether it's paranoia or completely justified suspicion. And we're going to handle it differently. You know, if this person has indeed stolen my ideas in the past, then trusting him does not seem like a good move. If this person has actually done me no wrong in the past, I'm just anticipating stuff that's never happened so far, we've got a very different situation. And it's not, is this PTSD or paranoia? Diagnoses aren't one to, per customer. You know, the lady on the videotape has both PTSD and paranoid personality disorder, you know, would be my bad. You know, and, you know, Gary met criteria for paranoid personality disorder and maybe generalized anxiety disorder. I, you know, I don't remember if I say in the book or not. It's been a while since I saw Gary. So, you know, we're going to want to work collaboratively with the person, which means negotiating goals that matter to them, and we're going to want to choose what to get to first. Their vote is going to have a big impact on what we choose to get to first, but I'm also going to want to think strategically. And you remember my general concept in dealing with paranoid personality disorder is if early on in therapy I can use some interventions that increase the person's sense of self-efficacy, that's likely to A, be helpful by toning down the intensity of their anxiety and stress and so on, but also, you know, makes it easier to tone down the vigilance, to tone down the guardedness and defensiveness, which will take some of the intensity out of the self-perpetuating cycles and make it easier to use other interventions effectively. So I want to try to get to increasing self-efficacy relatively early in therapy, so I'm going to be watching for good opportunities to do that. How do we do that? Well, at the top of page 9, we got some ideas about increasing self-efficacy. So, you know, one part of it is going to be, you know, establishing a good working relationship and maintaining it so that we're in a position to use interventions. And if you stop and think about it, if I'm dealing with somebody who's inclined to think that other people are, you know, deceptive and malicious and quick to take advantage of them, wait a minute, I'm a person too. You know, it may be a little complex to develop a good working relationship here. Now, one of the interesting things about paranoid personality disorder is some people with paranoid personality disorder just step through the door and put me on the good list and trust me for no obvious reason. This is not reality-based. They don't know me from Adam. They don't know, you know, would you advise your friends and relatives to, you know, imagine one of your friends or relatives needs therapy and by virtue of their health insurance coverage, they have to choose somebody on a panel. You don't know anybody on that panel. They're essentially choosing somebody at random based on their zip code. Would you advise them to blindly trust, you know, whoever they randomly happen to see? You know, it would be great if every therapist was competent and trustworthy and benevolent, etc. But the reality is therapists are humans and there's good, bad, and mediocre ones. You know, the clients who come in and blindly trust me, this is not actually terribly reality-based, but it's handy. I'm not going to challenge it. I'm not going to, you know, if it's not a problem, I'm not going to mess with it. And some paranoid individuals come in and just blindly trust me, and I don't have to see about establishing trust. But it's no big surprise if there are plenty of paranoid individuals who come through my door skeptical and hesitant to trust me. And so the first challenge is how do we develop a good working relationship? Any thoughts? How do I would go about getting somebody to trust me if they step through the door not trusting me? Well, if I get all huffy and offended that this person doesn't trust me, does that help me establish trust? No, it gets in the way. So one thing that's really useful is to get into an accepting stance. You know, is there any reason to be offended if somebody doesn't blindly trust me without knowing me? No, that's actually realistic on their part. And so if I can respond non-defensively when the person doesn't trust me, that doesn't result in trust, but at least I'm not making the situation worse. Do I want to try to convince the person to trust me? Now, that backfires. You know, when I was a kid, you know, we went out for a Sunday drive, and we happened to drive past Honest John's used cars. And my dad's comment was, anybody who has to tell you they're honest isn't. And my dad is a very non-paranoid guy. He's actually a lot like me. That if you try to convince somebody to trust you, that's really likely to backfire. How do I get somebody to trust me? Well, the best method I've been able to come up with is suppose I establish a track record of being trustworthy. Suppose I'm clear and upfront and then follow through on what I say I'm going to do. Suppose I take confidentiality seriously. Suppose I treat the person with respect. That actually works quite well with paranoid individuals. Well, wait a minute. Aren't I, you know, honest and trustworthy and et cetera with everybody? Well, it's handy to pay attention. You know, one discussion that came up just recently on the OPA listserv is actually, you know, therapists can get sloppy about talking about clients within the earshot of other clients, leaving charts lying around where they can be seen, and so on. And, you know, I may be able to get away with sloppiness with a lot of clients if I'm dealing with somebody who's vigilant. then talking about clients where it can be overheard, not a good move. Leaving charts out where they can be seen is not a good move. No, actually, I probably shouldn't do that even when I can get away with it. And so it's handy to pay attention to, am I doing a good job of keeping the confidential stuff confidential? Am I doing a good job of treating clients with respect? You know, and I may notice some areas that are in need of improvement there. And am I following through on what I say I'm going to do? One of the things that's real handy to be aware of is it's easy to get sloppy. You know, if I do an individual evaluation with somebody, there's reason to get information from their primary care doc. It's easy to say, well, I'll touch base with Dr. Schwartz before our next appointment. And let's suppose Dr. Schwartz is out of town. The client who is trying to figure out whether to trust me or not may well follow up. Did you get hold of Dr. Schwartz? And then I say, no, he was out of town. And then immediately I see the nonverbal cues. The person's posture shifts to a more closed position. They back off from me. Their facial expression changes. Gee, you had a strong reaction to that. What's going on? Well, you said you'd talk to him and you didn't. Oops, I didn't indeed say I would talk to them. And I indeed did not talk to them. And it's real natural to get into, you know, defending him out. Well, but I tried to, I intended to, I didn't know he was going to be out of town. And now, not only did I not follow through on what I said, but I'm coming up with excuses to get myself off the hook. This is making things worse, not better. A, it's real handy to think before I offer stuff rather than saying, I'll talk to Dr. Schwartz before the next visit. It works a lot better if I have the presence of mind to say, I'll try to get hold of Dr. Schwartz before our next visit. I want to offer things that are under my control. I don't have control over whether I reach Dr. Schwartz or not. He may or may not return phone calls. He may or may not be in town. I do have control over whether I make the attempt. So it's a lot cleaner if I offer to make the attempt. Then it's incumbent upon me to remember to do it and make the attempt. In my case, that means I better write it down. Now, then, when the client checks up on me the next session because they're trying to figure out whether they can trust me or not, you know, they say, did you get hold of Dr. Schwartz? I say, I tried, but he was out of town. We still get the same, and they still shift to a closed posture, and et cetera. And, gee, you had a strong reaction. Well, you said you'd get hold of him, and you didn't. Well, actually, the way I remember it was I said I would try to get hold of him, and I did indeed try to get hold of him. Unfortunately, he was out of town. And then you see the person's posture relax as it sinks in. Oh, wait a minute, I did actually follow through on what I said. And if I have the presence of mind to only offer things I'm willing and able to follow through on and then follow through on them, I still need to notice misperceptions and clear them up promptly. Because the person's vigilance will result in the misinterpreting stuff sign. But that works pretty damn good. Am I going to always have the presence of mind to think before I open my mouth? No, I'm human. And so on the times when, oops, I did indeed offer to do something and did not follow through on it, or worded poorly, so I said I would talk to Dr. Schwartz, and I didn't because Dr. Schwartz was out of town. Rather than coming up with excuses and defending myself and justifying it, it works a whole lot better to take the responsibility. You're right. I said I would talk to him. I didn't succeed in doing that. And if I forgot to, I forgot. That's not good. I need to be, you know, I better write it down this time. You know, or, you know, if I said I would talk to him, I called his office, he was out of it. You're right, I didn't get hold of him. You know, I shouldn't have offered to do something that I couldn't guarantee following through on. That works just fine. You know, paranoid individuals don't expect me to be infallible. They can live with me screwing up some as long as I don't do it too often. But it works much better to take responsibility, to validate their feelings, and to come up with a solution than to come up with an excuses or react as though they're being unreasonable in not liking it when I don't follow through on what I say. And establishing a track record of being trustworthy works great as a way of establishing trust. It does take a little while. It takes following through, and it takes noticing and clearing up misinterpretations.
See, you have to kind of maintain your own kind of vigilance to do your best to avoid confirming what they believe about the world.
Yeah. Another thing that makes a big difference in the interpersonal relationship is treating the client with respect. And, hey, I treat everybody with respect. But is it obvious to the client? And paranoid individuals sometimes get into some pretty idiosyncratic ways of playing this out. I had one paranoid individual I saw for quite a while where, you know, if you've seen our offices from being over there at Role Plays, we've got, you know, a couch or two, some chairs. There's no chair that's obviously the therapist's chair. You know, and, you know, I usher the person in front of me. You know, they choose where to sit down. I sit down across from them. And right there, that puts us on equal footing. You know, there's some therapist's office where the therapist is in a big, impressive chair behind the desk, and the client is in a little dinky chair in front of the desk, which immediately establishes a power differential. You can get away with that with a lot of clients. Dependent clients actually are likely to love it. Not a good idea with paranoid clients. That immediately rubs them the wrong way, because if I expect people to be malicious and deceptive and try to do them in, then if they've got power over me, this is really threatening. If we're on equal footing, that's a lot less threatening. So in terms of just furniture arrangement, nonverbals, and so on, I want to establish an even footing. You know, I had my paranoid client I was referring to, he wanted me to address him as Mr. Smith, and he addressed me by my first name. Mm-hmm. Do I want to get all huffy about that? Okay, he's pulling a power play here. Hey, my ego is okay. I don't need to get bent out of shape. I don't have to prove that he can't, you know, pull rank on me. He wants to be addressed as Mr. Smith, I'll address him as Mr. Smith. He wants to address me as Jim, fine with me. I don't need to fight that battle. Does no harm whatsoever. And if this results in him feeling safer, great. You know, a lot of paranoid individuals are skeptical about me taking notes. How do I handle that? Well, the same way I do with everybody else in the first round, I explain what's going on here. You know, often the details of what you tell me, how things are worded, so on, make a difference. If I try to do this in my head, I'm going to get some stuff right and get some stuff wrong. You know, if I write the important stuff down or the stuff that might be important down, then I'm less likely to forget it. I'm more likely to get it right. You know, this helps me be more effective. And with a lot of paranoid clients, that's fine. That makes sense to them. They're cool with it from that point on. Now, there are also plenty of paranoid individuals who are still a little skeptical. And, you know, I explain the limits of confidentiality and then follow through on that. And I also let them know if they ever want to see what I've written down, fine with me. You know, just let me know. They can read my notes whenever they want to. With this Mr. Smith, he got into a routine. At the beginning of each session, he'd ask for my notes from the last session. He'd read through them. He'd correct them. He'd hand them back to me. You know, take 2 minutes, and we'd go on with the session. And that made him comfortable with me writing stuff down. You know, and I'm much more effective when I can write stuff down than when I can't. You know, every once in a while, there's a client who is so concerned about confidentiality that they're not willing for me to write stuff down during the session. You know, I may be willing to, if, you know, that's going to slow things down, it's going to make it harder for me to be effective, but I can work that way if I need to. I might well sign on to that. However, most of the time, people who are that concerned about confidentiality are also not willing for me to maintain any records at all. Am I willing to do that? No way, Jose. Not only would the licensing board take a very dim view of that, you know, and the insurance company take a very dim view of that, but also those clients are the ones who are most likely to sue a therapist, and if I get sued and I've got no records, I'm really up the creek. You know, if somebody's not willing for me to maintain appropriate records, they can go shop for a different therapist and see if there's anybody in town foolish enough to do that. Unfortunately, there are. But this is not good. Yeah?
Do you discuss the diagnosis with your personality disorder?
Not routinely, because I've got more important things to do.
Mm-hmm.
If the person asks, I'll discuss it with them. And part of establishing trust is being open and straightforward and willing to answer questions and so on. Now, in discussing diagnosis with them, I want to understand what the question is. You know, if the person says, you know, what's my diagnosis, doc? You know, they might want to know what DSM has to say. Or they might really be asking, am I crazy or not? You know, or they might be asking, what do you think of me? So I might want to find out, you know, what do you have in mind there? You know, what is it that you want to know? In presenting the diagnosis, you know, I'm going to frame it, you know, not in terms of this is what you are, but rather, you know, for better or worse, psychiatry has come up with a bunch of categories. You know, one category, you know, is for people who have these characteristics. Sounds like that's a pretty good match for you. You know, that's the diagnosis I use when I submit this for your insurance. You know, and I want to help people understand that diagnosis is not who they are. It's how we categorize stuff. You know, and, you know, people get into big debates as to whether diagnosis is a good, bad, and mediocre thing. You know, if people want to use their insurance, I need to put down a diagnosis. You know, if people don't want to use their insurance and want to pay out of pocket, then diagnoses are optional. You know, I don't make those rules. Mm-hmm.
Just one small one. You were talking about the note taking.
Mm-hmm.
I have one client. I didn't have him for 3 years. He was paranoid like that. So what mm-hmm. I did was, when he sent me write notes, it was like every 5 seconds, What are you writing? So I said, you know what? We're gonna work this together. You write down, and I write down. I said, mm-hmm. Now it's gonna take up your time.
Yeah.
But toward 15 minutes before it's time for us to check out.
Mm-hmm.
You write down what you want me to do, and I write down what I wrote. Mm-hmm. And that works out.
That's a fine way to handle it. And if I'm doing that, then there are going to be points in the session where, you know, he tells me a specific thought, and I'll say, quick, write that one down so we get the wording right. Mm-hmm. You know, now, there are a lot of clients where after they've done that a few sessions, then they'll be happy for me to take over the work. But I've got, you know, You know, and there are actually a lot of advantages to having the client write stuff down, as long as they're okay with me taking a look at it. And for people who do a bad job of retaining what's covered at the end of the session, you know, one option is to, if they leave the session with a summary of the high points written down, that improves recall. One option is I could write down the high points and hand it to them. That works okay. It works even better if you hand them a blank 3x5 card and ask them, what are the most important things we covered today? A, you find out what they spotted, but then you can also, well, we also talked about such and so. You know, is that important? Yeah, why don't you write that? And if they write it down on the card, not only do they have a card with the high points on it, but the process of discussing it and writing it down helps them retain what's been covered. You know, and for people who have memory issues, this can be useful. Often clients will, you know, ask, can they record the session so they can listen to it again later? And it's fine with me if they want to do that. But the drawback to a recording is you have to listen to it beginning to end, because you don't know, was it 32 minutes into the session that the good stuff happened? You know, actually writing down the high points is more useful for most people. Meanwhile, back at paranoid personality disorder. So let's assume for the moment that we've done a decent job about being clear and upfront, treating people with respect, establishing a track record of being trustworthy, clearing up misconceptions. We've got a decent working relationship. You know, early on, I'm going to want to watch for opportunities to work to increase a person's sense of self-efficacy. You know, as Anne's another case example from the book, woman, late 20s, married, no kids, working in a clerical position at a local company, came in again for help with stress management. And in the initial evaluation, when I inquired further, you know, what are the main sources of stress? Well, everybody at work is making noise and dropping things just to get to me. People, you know, are trying to get me in bed with the boss. And it turned out this was not specific to this job, but this is the way she saw people in general over an extended period of time. And, this was obvious at first that there was an element of paranoia here. And we negotiated goals, which was primarily stress management. Okay, great. So we start focusing on stressful situations one at a time, looking at the situation, what led up to it, thoughts and feelings. And this gives me a bunch of good opportunities to work on increasing self-efficacy. And remember, self-efficacy is my sense of the demands of the situation and my sense for the capabilities, my capabilities for handling it. If it seems like I can handle this stuff, my self-efficacy is going to be decent. If it seems like the situation places demands on me that I can't handle, my sense of self-efficacy is going to be low. So, in my great wisdom, I say to Anne, gee, you're reacting as though this is a really dangerous situation. What risk do you see in this situation? Well, people might make noise and drop things just to get to me. Yeah, and from what you said, it sounds like when they do that, it's really aggravating. Is it just aggravating, or is there more to it than that? And, they keep trying to turn the boss against me. Yeah. Okay, so they make noise and drop stuff. This is aggravating to you. And they try to turn the boss against you. Other risks, and basically, she's been reacting as though it's a life and death situation. And by just asking about the specifics, it shifts from, oh my God, I'm in terrible danger here, to people might be a pain in the butt. And all I've done so far is collect information. I haven't even done anything impressive. But looking specifically at what risks there are in this situation is real useful. And then we can look at options for dealing with. So, as you see it, first of all, people may, make noise and drop stuff to get to you, and this is really aggravating. What options do you have for dealing with that? Oh, there's nothing I can do about it. Well, wait a minute. How long has this been going on? About 3 years, since you first took this job. How have you been dealing with it up to this point? Well, I do my best not to let it show. I put up with this noise and stuff being dropped and so on. Hold it in as long as possible. And then I go home and take it out of my husband. And from what you're saying, it sounds like you've been doing that for about 3 years. You're not happy with it, but it's worked well enough to get by. Do you see any reason you couldn't keep that up for a little while longer if you chose to? Well, no. So we've gone from a life and death situation I can't do anything about to an aggravating situation that I can handle in a dysfunctional way, and I can keep handling a dysfunctional way if I want to. And without even changing anything, her sense of self-efficacy has gone up a couple notches. You also said, seems like they're trying to turn your boss against you. How much luck have they had so far?
None.
And sounds like, from what you're saying, they've been trying to do this for about 3 years. They've been trying to do it for 3 years and haven't had any luck so far. Any reason to believe they're suddenly going to become more successful? Not that she could think of. And so this has shifted from a big threat to a much smaller threat. But it makes perfect sense that you would prefer your boss not to turn against you. Suppose somebody would prefer their boss not to turn against them, and some co-workers are trying to. What could a person do to improve the chances of the boss not turning against them? Well, I'm not brown-nosing anybody. So it sounds like you're saying brown-nosing is one option, but you don't want to do that. Are there other options, or are there other things a person could do if they, don't want their boss to turn against them? And she couldn't think of anything. Some people would figure, if I don't want my boss to turn against me,
it would be a good move to try to do my job well. But you know, well, I always do my job well. Okay, so it sounds like you're already doing something that a lot of people would argue improves the odds of the boss not turning against you. You know, and of course, other people would argue if I don't want my boss to turn against me, it might be a good idea to be reasonably polite and courteous, treat the boss with respect, etc. What do you think of that? Well, I guess I could say hi to them when they come in and, you know, say yes, sir, when they give me a new assignment. Okay. And it sounds like that wouldn't count as brown nosing. You know, what do you think? Would that be worth trying to see if it turns out to be a good idea or not? And about that point, we ran out of session time and ended up with the homework assignment of trying some of the stuff out in real life. And she came back, you know, the next week reporting that people at work had been a lot less obnoxious. They hadn't been dropping stuff and making noise and trying to turn the boss against her. I don't know. I wasn't there at work. My bet, I would bet a large pile of money that people's behavior at work did not change at all. But she was being less vigilant, she was feeling less vulnerable, she was less on guard. And so she was noticing, actually, a lot of the noise and stuff being dropped is accidental. And it's also not a big deal. And then we went on and worked on plenty of other stuff, too. How's all that sound so far?
So, did you have a conversation about this? How come things wasn't as bad as it used to be? Did you have, because I ran into a lot of
and that's a choice. When a person, you know, goes forth and does something differently and it produces good results, it's often a good way to say, wait a minute, you did this, this is what happened, hey, that turned out to be a good idea, why don't you keep up the good work? However, you know, particularly early in therapy with a paranoid individual, we're dealing with somebody who's guarded and defensive and sensitive about blame and criticism and so on. And if I point out, hey, you did some things differently and it worked, that implies that they weren't doing things right beforehand, and that can be tricky. And so I want to, you know, choose whether to, what to point out and what not to point out, rather than just automatically, you know, leaping into stuff. And if it seems to me that the person is not registering, oh, this is a good idea, then I need to get them to register it's a good idea. I might want to do it through guided discovery rather than telling them. You know, I might want to say, so what did you try doing differently this week? You know, when you tried it, how did other people react? What do you think? Is that a good or bad idea? And if I use guided discovery, that's much less likely to come across as criticism, blame, etc. The person. Now, I need to be careful because if it comes across as a cross-examination, that gets a different set of bad reactions. So there's a fair amount of subtlety to figuring out how to handle the interpersonal part of this.
No,
but you know, and so I want to, you know, choose to what extent to point stuff out. If the person is on their own realizing that, oh, this really is a good idea, then I don't need to point it out. You know, if the person doesn't get it, then I want to call it their attention in a way that's not going to come across as criticism or blame. You know.
And you mentioned before how you used CBT with chronic pain. And can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, but not in the middle of discussing paranoid personality disorder. So we're going to have some consultation time. You know, that's one of the things we could get to, particularly if anybody's got a chronic pain patient they'd like some input with, or something I could feel questions about once I've covered what I need to get to this morning. And I'll try to save time for that. And so one level of increasing self-efficacy is helping the person look realistically at the demands of the situation, look realistically at the capabilities they've already got for dealing with it, and often it turns out that, you know, a realistic view results in a much higher level of self-efficacy. Another option we've got is we can help the person develop new coping skills or improve the skills they've got. That's going to increase self-efficacy. We can also notice and address cognitive processes that undercut their sense of self-efficacy. For example, Gary, you know, is a professional in a health-related field, doing well in grad school, doing well on his job. Seems like he should have a pretty good high sense of self-efficacy. But actually, his self-efficacy was an ongoing problem. And turned out that a big chunk of what was going on was that, as he saw it, if you're competent, you do hard tasks well, and you're comfortable while you do it. But he was anxious. And he constantly interpreted this as a sign of incompetence. So how do I want to address that? Well, one option, one good option is, he's talking as though one is either competent or incompetent. That sounds like we might have some dichotomous thinking here. If so, we got the good old continuum technique, which happens to be one of my favorite techniques. I like to rule it out when I get a good opportunity. And so in my great wisdom, I say, gee, Gary, you're talking as though a person's either competent or incompetent. You know, sounds pretty biased. Is something that's black and white? And his response is, yeah. You know, that's the way it is. You're either competent or you're incompetent. That's the way it is. And then I can say, oh, well, this sounds like something important. Let's take a step back and take a look at that for a moment. Because it seems like this gut feeling that you're not competent has a big impact, makes things a lot more stressful. I want to have a clear connection to his goals here. You know, imagine a little guy comes down from Mars knowing nothing about humans and wants to be able to tell who's competent and who isn't. What should he look at? What are the characteristics of somebody who's truly competent? And Gary's response, and this is down at the bottom half of page 9, well, a competent person does hard tasks well. They get good results. And I could write that down in his words. You know, well, gee, a lot of people would look at your track record and say you do hard tasks well and get good results, but you don't find yourself feeling competent. What's going on there? Well, you know, if you're competent, you feel comfortable and relaxed while you do hard tasks well and get good results. I'm anxious all the time. Okay, so I'll write down, oh, so a truly competent person is relaxed while they do the task. And I worry about stuff afterwards. That wouldn't happen if I was competent. Oh, a competent person doesn't worry about it afterwards. You know, a competent person catches and corrects their mistakes. And I write that down. And I read, also, a truly competent person does hard tasks well and gets good results. They're relaxed while they do it. They don't worry about it afterwards. They catch and correct their mistakes. Does that cover it? Oh, a competent person knows their limits. I write that down. I repeat the other. Yeah, that's it. Those are the characteristics of a truly competent person. And what would be a good label for the people who aren't competent? You know, in this case, it turns out to be, oh, well, if you're not competent, you're incompetent. Great. What are the characteristics of a truly incompetent person? Well, an incompetent person screws everything up. I write that down. They don't do anything right. I write that down. So an incompetent person screws everything up. They don't do anything right. Does that cover it? Well, an incompetent person doesn't even care whether it's right or wrong. You know, they don't care how they look to others. I quick write those down. I repeat the attack. You know, you can't expect results from an incompetent person. And I repeat all this back. He said, yeah, that's it. You know. And so, once I've gotten the two ends of the continuum anchored, then we take a specific concrete example. Well, let's look at how, you know, you did today at work. You were telling me you were really stressed and anxious today. You know, if we look at, you know, what it takes to qualify as competent, you know, how did you do in terms of doing hard tasks well? Well, I actually did just fine. Okay. But, you know, number two on the list here is being relaxed while you do it, and you were saying, no, you were stressed and anxious. You know, you also said, you know, a competent person doesn't worry about it afterwards. Have you been worrying? Oh, you've been worrying about it afterwards. And we go down the list, and voila, Gary does not qualify as totally competent by his definition. So, and it sounds like the idea has been, if you're not competent, you're incompetent. Well, let's take a look at that. An incompetent person screws everything up. did you screw everything up today? No, you just told me you did your job well, you got to my office on time. You know, number two here is an incompetent person doesn't do anything right. Wait, it sounds like you've done a number of things right today. You know, you said an incompetent person doesn't care whether it's done right. Well, wait a minute. What are you stressed and anxious about? What are you upset about? Sounds like you really care whether it's done right. Doesn't sound like what you qualify on as incompetent on that one. Sounds like it's turning out that you're not totally competent or totally incompetent. What do you make of that? You know, let's imagine a rating scale from 0 to 10, where 0 is absolutely totally incompetent, 10 is absolutely totally competent. Where would you fall on that? I think he rated himself at about a 7. And so, on that level, we're addressing the dichotomous thinking, and that was actually quite useful. Another part, you know, that I didn't follow up with is, one of the ideas here is if a person's totally competent, they're going to be, you know, relaxed while they do the task, they don't worry about it afterwards. What do you think of that? You know, if somebody's anxious, if somebody worries, does that prove they're not competent? And, you know, gee, it had always seemed that way to him. He was not at all sure about that. Well, let's try out a concrete example. Imagine we got two guys, we want to find out who's a competence learner. We fly them to England, you know, walk to the beach at Dover, have them jump in the water, you know, guy number one jump in the water and swim to France. He swims across the English Channel, he survives, he makes it there. Most people figure, yes, he's demonstrated that he's a competence learner. How's that sound? Guy number two, we have him strap on 20 pounds of iron chain. He hops in, swims across the English Channel, makes it to France. Well, gee, most people, he's demonstrated he's a competent swimmer too. And if anything, he's the better swimmer because he made it despite an obstacle. You know, how's that sound so far? Makes sense. Now, when you're doing your job, dealing with all this complicated, stressful stuff, and you're anxious, does being anxious make it easier to do your job or harder? Oh, it makes it a lot harder. And yet you end up getting good results. Does this show that you're incompetent? Or does doing well despite an impediment actually show greater competence than if you could only do your job well when you were calm? And he stopped, and he thought, and actually, yeah, it doesn't seem like being anxious while I do my work proves I'm incompetent. If I get good results, I get good results. The anxiety and stress is a pain in the butt. But that's a separate question from whether I'm competent or not. You know, and that was a real useful realization. And you know, from that point on, we were able to, you know, boost his self-efficacy, which, you know, ended up being really useful. How's all that sound? Now, if we succeed, and oh, another thing I did with Gary, which is getting a little fancy at the top of page 10, is one of the follow-ups you can do with the continuum technique is if there's something that the client's treating as monolithic and you want to differentiate it some, you know, if he's reacting as though competence is one across-the-board entity. And one thing I had him do for homework is I broke it into 5 separate rating scales. The degree to which he was doing hard tasks well, to the degree to which he was relaxed while he did it, etc. And I had him rate his job performance, his school performance, and his relationship performance, you know, during the week, you know, as a homework assignment. And you see, you know, in all three, he did pretty decent in terms of doing hard tasks well. In terms of being relaxed about it, he was a lot more nervous about his job than he was about school or relationship. In terms of not worrying about it, he worried about job and relationship. He didn't particularly worry about school. And this helps break it up and helps it register. This is not a monolithic entity. You know, doing it well is different from being relaxed about it, is different from worrying about it. You know, now, this is a high-functioning, intelligent, insightful, philosophically-minded guy, and this worked well with him.
You know, there are lots of perfectly fine clients where this would completely blow past them and is a waste of energy. You know, so I want to pick and choose which technique to use with which person. Now, if we succeed in increasing the sense of self-efficacy, backing off a little bit on the vigilance, backing off a little on the guardedness, you know, round two is going to be taking specific interpersonal situations and helping the person spot more promising ways of handling it. You know, generally like, okay, this situation is a problem for you. How have you been handling it so far? How's that turn out for you? What are the good points? What are the drawbacks? Are you interested in seeing if there are any better ways to deal with this situation, anything that might be more effective? And, you know, if the person signs on to that, then a social problem-solving framework, an interpersonal problem-solving framework, is a pretty useful one, and that's down at the bottom of page 10. This is stolen from some of Zaria's work. And first of all, we want to help a person establish a problem orientation. A lot of people, not just paranoid individuals, but paranoid individuals in particular, come in an uproar, just they're upset that the other person said or did what they did. It shouldn't be this way. I can't take this anymore, etc. And that results in a lot of uproar without a whole lot of progress. And so round one is I want to see about switching from uproar to problem-solving mode. And a good starting point is, how about some empathy? Gee, it sounds like you're really upset about this. It sounds like this really gets to you. It sounds like this drives you up the wall. Would you be interested in seeing if we can figure out a promising way to deal with this situation? And, you know, often the person's willing to switch from protest mode to problem-solving mode. Great. You know, round two is, what's the goal here? What's the problem with this situation? And what's the goal? What are you trying to accomplish? Often people are very focused on what they object to, and they haven't even thought about what they're shooting for. And once we have a, you know, I want to get this idiot to turn his radio down. Okay. You know, that's, you know, if we start with my coworker is an inconsiderate asshole and discuss the situation and it turns out, oh, the coworker has his radio on too loud and our client's goal is to get the guy to turn down his radio, that makes the situation a lot more manageable right there. But then we can take a look at what are the options? What alternatives are worth considering? You know, if I want a coworker to turn down his radio, or if I want the coworker's radio not to bother me, what could I consider? You know, I could consider asking him to turn it down. I could consider, you know, sneaking in and unplugging his radio. I could consider complaining to the boss. And what works best is rather than just coming up with good ideas, a brainstorming approach where you come up with a bunch of ideas, good, bad, and mediocre, you know, I could sneak in and cut the cord on his radio. Now, we're not going to end up choosing that option, but if you try to just come up with good ideas, the client may well feel like they're being railroaded. If you come up with a range of options, good, bad, and mediocre, and then choose the most promising ones, that generally results in a lot less resistance. And then we're going to want to look at, with each of the options, you know, what are the good points, what are the bad points, how does the client think that would work out in real life, which of these are worth trying? How would one try this out in real life? And then go home, try it out, see what the results are, learn from the results. Pretty simple, straightforward, common sense. But a lot of clients are not real good at problem solving. And A, this gives me a framework which helps me keep clear what I'm trying to accomplish. But also, in addition to our potentially coming up with a solution for this particular situation, you know, we also... hopefully, the person will get better at the problem-solving process and will eventually get to the point where they can do this on their own better. One thing that's important is we want to stay reality-based rather than just thinking, what's supposed to be a good idea if I'm dealing with reasonable human beings? You know, it's easy to presume, hey, if I want my coworker to turn his radio down, I should ask him to turn the radio down, right? It depends on the coworker. That may well turn out to be a good idea. Or it might be totally ineffective, or it might result in the idiot turning his radio up because he's trying to jerk me around.
you know, that we don't want to presume that the results are going to be what we would expect. We want to, in this workplace setting, how's it likely to turn out if they ask the guy nicely to turn down this radio? Yeah.
So what about a problem that it is a problem for a partner or someone else's in the office, but your client doesn't see it's a problem?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's creating a problem.
Well, if they don't see it's a problem, mm-hmm. then we're not going to work on problem solving until they do see it as a problem. So I'm going to want to think, is it a problem for the client? If so, how do I get the client to see that it's a problem for them? Now, if it's a problem for their spouse, their boss, whoever, and not a problem for the client, well, is my job here to help the client solve other people's problems, or is it my job here to help them solve their own problems? And it's easy to lose track of that, you know, particularly if you're working with kids and adolescents. It's easy to, you know, end up working on solving the parents' problems with the kid rather than helping the kid solve their own problems. And if I'm trying to impose somebody else's agenda on the client, this is challenging to do in a lot of situations. If I'm dealing with paranoid personality disorder and I'm trying to impose somebody else's agenda on the client, this is not going to work. They are going to fight tooth and nail. They are going to win on that one. So what I'm going to want to do is use a motivational interviewing approach where the first round is using guided discovery to help them see how this is a problem for them. You know, if the boss is pissed that I don't show up for work on time and I don't see this as a problem, are there any ways in which this is a problem? How does the client feel about the boss being pissed at them? What impact does it have in their life that their boss is pissed at them? Are there any drawbacks to having their boss be pissed at them? You know, suppose they continue pissing off their boss. You know, is this likely to result in the job situation improving, or is this likely to result in the job situation getting worse? If they continue pissing off their boss, is this, you know, risk having any effects on job security? And, gee, if I'm doing stuff that pisses off my boss, it's likely to turn out that, there are ways in which this is a problem for me. But if we use guided discovery so that the client is telling me how this is a problem for them, that works a whole lot better than me trying to convince the client that it's a problem for them. Okay. And so what we're shooting for is to increase self-efficacy, tone down the vigilance and guardedness, switch to more promising interpersonal behavior, which then hopefully will start producing better results. And now there's still some evidence that supports the person's view that others are deceptive and malicious and so on. And there's also evidence that doesn't support it. So now we can say, gee, it sounds like the idea is that people are malicious and deceptive. What do you think of that? You know, what do you see that convinces you that people are malicious and deceptive? And I'll give a long list. Do you see anything that doesn't fit with that idea? And they may well not spot anything. And, you know, if they don't, I can say, well, wait a minute. Didn't you tell me about, you know, your coworker filling in for you when you had to miss work for that meeting? You know, didn't you mention that person gave you a ride home when your car wouldn't start? And we can help the person notice, you know, be realistic about the times when people are malicious and deceptive and mean and hostile and so on, but also look realistically at the times when, A, people are nice and kind and generous, and also the times when it's none of the above. People are just ordinary. One of the homework assignments I used with Gary was for him to, as he rode the bus to and from work, notice how people treated him and keep a running tally of the times when people were malicious and hostile and deceptive and mean and the times when people were nice and kind and generous. And he came back the next week and was amazed to report that what he'd actually noticed was most of the time people were neither. They could care less. They had other stuff on their mind. They weren't mean to him. They weren't mean nice to them. They just sat on the bus and minded their own business. Which doesn't fit with the idea that people are uniformly malicious and deceptive and hostile and so on. You know, so that led us to consider, so one possibility is people across the board are malicious and hostile and deceptive. Another possibility is a lot of people, you know, have their own business to deal with and aren't malicious or benevolent. And some people are hostile and malicious and so on. And some people are nice and kind and generous. And some people are nice and kind sometimes and malicious and hostile other times and indifferent other times. It might not be the most fluent alternative to the idea that people are malicious and deceptive, but it's not a bad alternative. And now we can use behavioral experiments and the various belief change methods, you know, keeping a running tally of, you know, are people benevolent or malicious or neutral, to help the new assumption replace the old. Questions, comments, reactions? And obviously, as the person sees others differently, this makes it easier to tone down the vigilance, and we'll start talking about how to decide when to be vigilant and when not. One issue that generally comes up late in therapy with paranoid personality disorders, how do I decide who to trust and who not to trust? And often part of the problem is the person has no way of figuring out who to trust and who not to trust. How do I do that? A lot of therapists haven't really sat down and thought this through, even though you've come up with some way to decide who you trust and who you don't. You know, and with paranoid individuals, intuition is not a terribly promising way to go. You know, one way I approach it with clients is, imagine my coworker wants to borrow $5 from me. Do I trust him to pay me back or not? Well, I don't know. Seems like one way to approach it is, has this person borrowed money from me before? If so, did they pay me back promptly without nagging? In which case, sounds like trusting them to pay me back this time isn't guaranteed, but might be a pretty good bet. Did it take a lot of nagging to get paid back? Well, then that's probably a pretty good bet this time around. You know, have they not paid me back yet? That makes it sound like lending them more money is a donation, not a loan. You know, in deciding who to trust and who not to trust, might it make sense to look at the person's track record? You know, suppose this person has never borrowed money from me. I can't use that strategy. Have they borrowed money from other people at work? Do they pay those people back promptly without nagging, etc.? I don't have a guarantee they'll treat me the same as they treat other people. But if this somebody who pays other people back promptly without nagging, seems like they'd be a better bet than this is somebody who doesn't pay other people back. Now, suppose they've never borrowed money from me. I don't know if they're borrowing money from other people. I can't use those strategies. Seems like, I don't know. And the question is, do I want to invest $5 in finding out whether I can trust this person to pay me back? Or do I want to hang on to my $5? And both seem like reasonable options. And this makes sense to your average paranoid individual. And the general concept of looking at a person's track record and deciding who to trust and who not to trust ends up being really useful. Now, if we get to the point where we've chipped away the person's beliefs and assumptions and have come up with more adaptive alternatives. They're not being so rigid. They're not being so guarded and defensive. They're interacting with others in more promising ways and getting better results. It sounds like we might be approaching termination. And we're going to want to talk this over and do it collaboratively rather than just bringing it on the person. And we're going to want to work some on relapse prevention. And the usual approach of thinking about high-risk situations and early warning signs and planning for them makes a lot of sense. And one of the things I now want to make a point of addressing as part of the relapse prevention process is, suppose I cross paths with somebody who is malicious and deceptive, who does try to take advantage of me, who does try to do me in. Because if we don't talk that over with the person before treatment ends, you know, they're likely to go forth with their new beliefs and assumptions. They cross paths with somebody who's malicious and deceptive, and they say, oh my God, people really are malicious and deceptive, and they bounce back. This is not the desired outcome. If we talk it over with the person as part of relapse prevention, we can get it to register. We're not saying nobody's malicious and deceptive. We're not saying that nobody's going to try to take advantage of them. What we're saying is, this isn't true of people in general. You know, I want to be selective about who I trust and who I don't trust. You know, I want to be on guard when I need to be on guard and not be on guard when it's unnecessary. And I can deal with this stuff. I don't need to freak out about it so much. And if we talk that through with the person, then, and we help them think through, when I do cross paths with somebody who's trying to lie and cheat and steal, how do I want to deal with that? Then we've got a much better chance of good long-term results. And with paranoid personality disorder, we don't have a whole lot of controlled outcome studies on paranoid personality disorder. You know, nobody's assembled a group of 60 paranoid individuals to do an outcome trial with. That would be a big project. We do have some good evidence that CBT works well with personality disorders in general. We've got data on some and not others. My clinical experience is it works quite well with paranoid personality disorder. Questions, comments, reactions? Now, circling back, in the handouts, on page 11, we've got a sample of Gary's first thought record. And if you look at it, this is okay. We've got situations, we've got emotions, we've got automatic thoughts. Voila, you can use thought records. Now, you notice it's not the most disclosing thought record ever. We got sort of one thought per situation. A bunch of them are questions. You know, we've got an emotion rated at 70%. It doesn't even say what the emotion is. You know, paranoid individuals early in therapy often aren't terribly self-disclosing, so we may need to ask some follow-up. Gee, you rated your emotion at 70%. You know, do you remember how you were feeling? What emotion was there? You know, were there other emotions as well? You know, you put down that your thought was, well, I have time to get all my work done. Great, this is what we're shooting for. Gee, that's a question. You know, at the moment when that was running through your head, you have an answer to that in mind. Oh, you were thinking, oh my God, I'm not going to get all my work done. Okay, that makes sense of the anxiety you're experiencing. Do you remember other thoughts as well? And so we're probably going to need to do some elaborating in the session, particularly at first, but it can be real useful. We've got a continuum on trust, helping the person think through their issues around trust can be real useful. And when a person's looking at trust in a dichotomous way, then continuum technique can be real useful. When you're working on the beliefs and assumptions, you often run into a point where things grind to a halt for no obvious reason, even though it seems like it should be abundantly clear that the old belief doesn't hold water and the new belief is more promising. And at that point, it's useful to look at the pros and cons of living by the old belief versus the pros and cons of living by the new belief. You see an example on page 12. And often, the person's got major fears about what will happen if they shift. And this, you know, has them grinding to a halt. And if you study discovery to look at their perceived advantages of the old belief and the perceived drawbacks of the new belief, that's often real useful in getting unstuck. In this case, the person's thinking, well, if I don't trust anyone, then I won't be deceived. Hey, that makes it sound like not trusting anybody is a great idea. Does it work that way out in real life? Okay, what's the evidence here? You know, what evidence do you see that if you don't trust anybody, you won't be deceived? Wait a minute, haven't we talked about a whole bunch of situations where you felt like you were being deceived? You know, we got this specific situation. It sounds like even if your policy is don't trust anybody, you end up being deceived anyway sometimes. And we cross that advantage off the list. You know, and with the new policy of sometimes choosing to trust some people, then I'd be vulnerable. Vulnerable to what? How vulnerable would you be? You know, what options do you have for dealing with that situation?
can be real useful getting stuff. Starting on page 13, it turns out that a bunch of the things we've talked about in dealing with paranoid personality disorder apply to personality disorders in general. And this is a list from a chapter that Barb and I wrote back in the 90s. With simple, straightforward people, you can often get away with a cookbook approach. The more complex things are, the more important it is to base interventions on an individualized conceptualization. This actually turns out to be a good idea with simple, straightforward stuff, too. But it becomes really important with access to disorders. If you try a generic cookbook approach, it does not work well at all. If you individualize things, it works a whole lot better. Having clear mutual goals makes a big difference. You know, therapy with access to disorders involves dealing with some real tricky, ticklish areas. It takes motivation and follow-through. If we don't have clear, meaningful goals the client's invested in, it's going to be real hard to get them to plug away and do what needs to be done. It's important to focus a lot of attention on the therapist-client relationship. A lot of the client's interpersonal issues are going to play out in therapy, too. You know, if you want to label it transference, feel free to. I think the analytic way of looking at transference has some shortcomings and also has some good points. You know, where do I pick up the idea that people are hostile and malicious and will do me in if they give me a chance? Well, Gary grew up in a family where this was true. First of all, his parents explicitly taught the kids not to trust anybody because people are malicious and deceptive. But also, if you showed any weakness, you were humiliated and taken advantage of in this family. His brother had cheated him of $20,000 in a business deal. One way to pick up the belief that people are malicious and deceptive is if I grow up in a corner of the world where this is true, and then I go out into the larger world as though my family of origin is typical of people in general. And I personally think the cognitive behavioral way of looking at this has some advantages over the psychodynamic way of looking at it, but we're really talking about the same phenomenon. And often an important chunk of what we're doing in therapy is helping the person register, wait a minute, people in general don't react the way my family reacted. Wait a minute, the experience I had when I was a kid is not, I've had several people who are afraid that if they make a mistake, everybody will point and laugh. And that's what happened to them in seventh grade. And they have a process, wait a minute, my coworkers don't react that way when somebody makes a mistake. We form an idea and then we carry it with us and we often don't get around to re-examining it. Early in therapy, it's handy if we can start off with interventions that don't require a lot of self-disclosure, because if we're still in the process of developing the collaborative relationship and getting the person comfortable with trust and self-disclosure and so on, then stuff that involves a lot of self-disclosure can be pretty ticklish. If there's some more straightforward surface-level stuff we can start off with, that enables us to make some headway and accomplish worthwhile stuff while the person's still getting comfortable with us. Turns out increasing self-efficacy is a good idea across the board, not just with paranoid personality disorder. It reduces anxiety, it reduces stress, it reduces the intensity of dysfunctional behaviors. So that's something that's pretty generically useful. It's real easy to slip into relying just on verbal interventions within the office. And it's real handy to register that verbal interventions can be useful, but they're not nearly as powerful as firsthand experience. Experiential exercises, behavioral experiments, trying stuff out in real life is a lot more powerful. If I'm not doing that, I'm not firing on all my cylinders. When we're trying to get people to do scary stuff, it's handy to understand their fears and process that before trying to get them to go forth and do it. As long as the person honestly believes that what we want them to do is dangerous, it's going to be hard as hell to get them to do it. If we can help them register that it's scary but not dangerous, then it's a lot easier to get them to follow through on doing what needs to be done, particularly if we break it down into manageable steps. We don't want to presume the client exists in a reasonable environment. Particularly, the more extreme the person's issues are, the more likely there is that they grew up in an extreme family, that they got married to somebody who has their own issues, that they work for somebody who has their own issues, etc. So the more extreme the person's problems are, the more likely it is to turn out that they live in a fairly screwy world, and we need to take that into account rather than presuming that the client's friends and relatives will react the way my friends and relatives would. And clients with access to issues often pull strong emotional reactions from therapists. You know, we need to be aware of this and handle it so it doesn't muck things up. And that's sort of the minimum level we need to pull off to provide effective treatment. If we can recognize our reactions and understand them, this can also generate added value. For example, every once in a while, I'm doing therapy with a client, and I find myself getting more and more depressed for no obvious reason. What's going on here? Well, so far in my life, that's happened in one and only one scenario. That's when clients have what's called sometimes called a masked depression, when the person's real depressed, but they're putting on a smiling face and acting less depressed than they are. For some reason, I pick up on it on the gut level before I register it intellectually. Now, if I'm getting more and more depressed, hey, I need to handle that so it doesn't muck up therapy. I don't want to give up and start venting about my own problems. But if I'm ready, wait a minute, I'm getting depressed for no obvious reason. What's going on here? Oh, this happens to me when the client's a lot more depressed than they let on. Is there any chance this client could be more depressed than they are? You know, can I check that out? You know, that my reaction to the client may give me some clues about the client. Or, you know, if the client's really dragging me up the wall, most clients don't drag me up the wall, this A may give me some idea about what sort of person I'm sitting across from, but B may give me some clues about how other people react to this client. You know, it also may put me into position, if we're at a point in therapy where it's a good idea, would you like some feedback about the impact this has on other people? You know, let me tell you about how I find myself reacting to it. Now, that can be tricky, but it also can be real useful. Most of us don't get a whole lot of honest feedback from others about how we come across. And there are points in therapy where the client can really benefit from some feedback if I can figure out how to present it in a way that's going to be useful rather than threatening. You know, one thing that I find real valuable with is, you know, rather than just bringing it on the person, asking, would you like some feedback? And if they say, hell no, then I don't give it to them. And if they say, yeah, sure, then they're asking for it, which means they're more likely to accept it. And as we get to the other personality disorders, we'll be hitting on a bunch of these points, and we'll see how it applies there. Questions, reactions? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we've got consultation time. So while you're hitting the bathroom, think about what you'd like input on. We've got some interest in chronic pain, you know, and it's completely optional whether it has anything to do with paranoid personality disorder or not. Everything is fair game.